So today we continue with our series on the Beatitudes, the short, pithy verses that comprise the beginning of what has been called Jesus' most important sermon, the Sermon of the Mount. Now, Jesus gives this sermon on the top of a mount overlooking the Sea of Galilee. And honestly, Bob and I were privileged to be there this summer to stand on that summit and look down to the sea and to stand where they think Jesus stood. However, honestly, it's not much of a mountain. It's really almost, it's more of a hill. And, you know, the incline is very gentle. In fact, some Bible scholars said it really should have been called the Sermon of the Mound and not the Sermon of the Mount. However, despite the fact that it was completely unnamed in Jesus' time, it was just an isolated hill, one of the many surrounding the Sea of Galilee, and despite the fact of its lack of height, it has referred to ever since, the mountain is referred to ever since as the Mountain of the Beatitudes. Now, as beautifully phrased as they are, and they are masterfully written, they have been quoted and misquoted, translated and mistranslated, understood and mostly misunderstood for centuries. Charles Roth, a longtime Unity minister, said, "The Beatitudes are an enigma. To this day, they're a puzzle to both Bible scholars and students of truth alike." So, depending on how closely you look at them, we really can realize that they are powerful precepts, not about right and wrong, not about rules and rituals, but about ways in which we can be, about attitudes of being that can help us understand the power of God and to know and place that power to work in our daily lives. And once again, I've showed this a few, couple weeks ago, the sources for today's lesson are four powerful sources about the Sermon on the Mount. They are Discover the Power Within You by Eric Butterworth, Meditations on the Mount by Ed Townley, The Sermon on the Mount by Emmett Fox, and the Archived Lessons of Charles Roth, I'm sorry, called the Beatitudes. Now, before we go further, I think it's important for us to remember what Charles Fillmore said about the Bible. He believed very strongly that every single one of us have all of the skills and the knowledge and the guidance within to navigate the scriptures and bring deep personal meaning from them for our lives today. This means after reading and maybe metaphysically interpreting the scriptures, there's another step. It's sometimes called maieutic. And it simply is to take those words, those phrases, that story into our souls, into our hearts, meditate about their meaning, and decide what they really do mean to us. This is a personal process. Every single person can do it. And every single person can realize, how does this story connect to me, my issues, my problems, my own spiritual growth? Now, because each of the Beatitudes builds so beautifully on the one before, I read one Bible scholar who said, well, you can take them in any order. But I respectfully disagree with that. I think they are in exactly the right order because each one builds on the one that comes before. So because of that, we're going to do a quick review of our first two Beatitudes that we talked about last week, and also knowing that maybe some of you were not here that day. So just to start with, remember the word beatitude is from the Latin beatus, which means to make happy, okay? And each beatitude begins not with the Old Testament law of thou shalt not, but it begins, each one begins with blessed are. Blessed is from the Greek word makarios, which means a self-contained happiness or bliss. And Charles Fillmore tells us that blessed means to invoke or call upon all of the goodness of God. So Jesus begins the Sermon on the Mount with this statement. Remember this from 2 weeks ago? Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Now, metaphysically, we discussed a couple weeks ago, this can mean, it can mean blessed, happy, in bliss are those poor or lacking in personal pride because they can be more open to the power of God. So the first beatitude is about openness and receptivity to God, and sometimes laying aside some of our old theology and being able to look at it in a new way. And then the second beatitude, blessed are they that mourn, for they will be comforted. Now, at the literal level, we know what that means, that God is always there to comfort us in sad times. But metaphysically interpreted, this one can mean to be happy in bliss, for they are the ones who are passionate and eager for a personal relationship to God. And that means they will be strengthened. That's what comfort means, strengthened. So beatitude number one, we have to be open. Beatitude number two, we have to really want that relationship with God. And so now we're going to continue, and I invite you now just to picture yourself on that hilltop at the top, overlooking the beautiful Sea of Galilee with just a small group of Jesus' disciples, but you are there. And just take these words in to your heart and to your soul. For clearly, those profound teachings of Jesus were not just meant for that small group in front of him that day. They were meant for every single one of us. So, the next beatitude, Jesus continues, blessed are the meek. Blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth. Now, at a literal level, this one doesn't make a whole lot of sense, does it? It really doesn't. Do we really believe in our society it's the meek who inherit the earth? A modern dictionary gives us these definitions. I just take these in and see how these feel to you. Are you ready? Submissive, yielding, obedient, timid, unprotesting. I see our modern connotation as being sort of like Mr. Milquetoast or Ms. Mouse, you know, non-assertive, avoiding all conflict, silently submitting to authority, soft and spineless. Now I ask you, are these the types who inherit the earth? I don't think so. Are these the people who become revolutionaries, visionaries, CEOs, world leaders? Probably not. I invite you, next week is Halloween. I invite you to just study the costumes of the kids who come to the door and see how many of their costumes speak of meekness. You'll see more dripping blood than we do in the emergency room. More, you know, scary masks and all that. So the idea that the weak inherit the earth really runs contrary to our societal expectations, our norms, doesn't it? Don't we all know that the squeaky wheel gets the grease? Might makes right. And its chain is only strong as its weakest link. Those are the things we believe in this society. And really, can this be the message coming out of the mouth of Jesus? The man who revolutionized religious thought 2,000 years ago? The man who stood up to the Pharisees and the scribes? The man who threw the money changers out of the temple? And the man who told us that we could just understand our Christ's presence as much as he understood his? I don't think so. And Emmett Fox tells us that this beatitude is among the half dozen verses in the Bible that are the most powerful teachings. He says, and I quote, "The fact is, when understood correctly, the meaning of this beatitude is not only true, but it is the most practical of all Jesus' doctrines. When you understand the spiritual meaning of this text, you will have," are you ready for this? "You will have the secret of dominion, the secret of overcoming every single difficulty on this earth. It's literally the key of life." Well, I don't know about you, but I'd like to have that key. That sounds like a good thing to have. So in order to grab onto that, let's look closely at the two key words in this beatitude. Blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth. And I'd like to start with the word earth. Earth in this context doesn't mean just the terrestrial globe. It really means manifestation, everything in the outer realm. And that's exactly what the globe represents in our wings symbol. It represents our earthly existence, our human experience. And the word meek has nothing whatever to do with the modern definitions I read you earlier. It does not mean weak. The true significance of meek is a mental attitude for which there is no English synonym. And boy, that makes it really hard, doesn't it? If we can't give a synonym to it, it's hard to understand. It's derived from a root that means equilibrium, in full possession of one's faculties of being. In other words, we might call it inner mastery. To be meek is to have that inner mastery, to be able to stay centered and in equilibrium. And the Greek word praesis has the connotation of harnessing that which is powerful and unrestrained, just as we today harness all the power of the Niagara Falls to manifest electricity. Fox defines it best, I think. He says, it is a combination of open-mindedness, so that kind of refers back to the first beatitude, faith in God, and realization that the will of God for us is always something more joyous and more vital than we could possibly imagine for ourselves. It's always greater. In other words, it's a state of mind where we establish, I guess we would call it a willingness to allow divine energy and divine power to flow. Our inner mastery comes when we, one of our favorite unity expressions, when we let go and let God. That's right. And I know some of you have visited the Lowell Fillmore Garden at the Unity Village, and it features this poem. And I'm going to read it to you and see if you remember it. It's called The Answer. And if you remember the poem The Answer, this was Charles and Myrtle's son Lowell who wrote this poem. When for a purpose I had prayed and prayed and prayed, until my words seemed worn and bare with arduous use, and I had knocked and asked and knocked and asked again, and all my fervor and persistence brought no hope, I paused to give my weary brain a rest and cease my anxious human cry, and in that still moment, after self had tried and failed, there came a glorious vision of God's power, and lo, my prayer was answered in that hour. Has that ever happened to you? Have you ever struggled and stressed and strained over a problem? And only at the point where you say to yourself, okay, I don't have all the resources, I can't do this, help me, God. Then what happens? Then the power and majesty of the divine flows, and answers come to us that we never would have been able to access with our little selves. So, really, I think this is all about surrender. This is about surrendering to God's power. And that's when we find a greater answer. Now, I think in our human skins, we don't much like that word surrender, do we? We don't. We equate it with defeat, giving up. Yet the beautiful paradox that Jesus presents here is that we inherit the earth. We bring harmony to the outer only when we realize that I of myself, my little self, my human self, can do nothing. It is the Christ within that does the work. And just think of it. We're in this season of change right now with this beautiful fall we're having. But just think of it. All the cycles of nature are about surrender. Only when fall surrenders to winter can there be a promise of spring, right? Only when the acorn surrenders its hold on that branch and falls to the ground can it start its journey in magnificence. And only when the caterpillar surrenders to that cocoon state can it be transformed into a beautiful butterfly. The Jafalos write, contrary to popular belief, surrender can be a positive action. Nothing new can happen until the old loses power. And I've used the quote before, which I love, when what the caterpillar calls the end, God calls the butterfly. And so when we surrender to this power and presence of the divine, we lose nothing. And in fact, we gain everything. So only when we surrender our human selves to our God and to our own divine essence of the Christ within can we become all that we are destined to be. And that leads us beautifully to the next beatitude, which is, Blessed are they who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be filled. Or some texts say they will be satisfied. Now, the terms hunger and thirst, are two conditions that would have been all too familiar to the people of Jesus' time in the ancient Near East. Today, we think we're hungry when we miss a meal. And we think we're thirsty if we forget our companion water bottles, don't we? I mean, that's how we define hunger and thirst. But many in Jesus' time lived constantly on the edge of starvation and were often traveling long distances through the dry desert with just regions of just so dry and sand filling their nostrils and throat and not a drop of water in sight. These people truly knew the meaning of hunger and thirst in a way that hopefully most of us never will. And the International Biblical Commentary notes that the words hunger and thirst, as used by Jesus, are simply expressions of strong desire. And desire for what? What does the Beatitude say? Hunger and thirst for? You are awake. Thank you. For righteousness. Absolutely. And if I ask you to picture in your minds a righteous person, what picture pops in your heads? Perhaps we think it means living by a strict religious code, going to church religiously, if you'll pardon the pun, picture somebody carrying a prayer book in one hand, a Bible in the other, or standing in the street corner, praying out loud so everybody could see him or her. But remember what Jesus says about the Pharisees, really just a few short verses after the Beatitudes. He says, surely they will have their reward. And Eric Butterworth says, it's unfortunate that religion for many of us is one grand cliche, and its practice is the repetition of pompous platitudes. So, this is a far cry from what Jesus meant by righteousness. In fact, in Matthew 5:20, again, just a few verses later, he says, for I tell you, unless your righteousness exceeds that of the scribes and the Pharisees, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven, meaning we will never fully realize the Christ within. And remember that all of the Beatitudes, these two being no exception, deal with one concept only. They don't deal with actions. They deal with states of mind, attitudes, not platitudes. And the word righteousness used here does not mean right action. Doesn't mean anything you do. It means right thinking, thinking rightly. Now, the great truth that Jesus is telling us here begins all the way back in Genesis 1:26, when we read, let humankind have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the air, over the cattle, over all the wild animals, and every creeping thing upon the earth. And guess what? Metaphysically, all of those animals and creeping things represent. Anybody guess? Anybody know? They represent different kinds. Different kinds of thoughts. They represent ideas we hold in our mind. And the great law, and we're told right there, that we have dominion over our thinking. Have you ever heard people say, oh, I can't help what I think? Well, if you can't, who can, right? I mean, you can't. We can. It takes practice, but we can. We do have dominion over our thinking. And the great rule, of the universe is that what we hold in mind produces its own kind first in our consciousness, and then from that infinite possibility in the universe, we draw ourselves to the patterns we hold in mind. And Emmett Fox says, what you think in your mind, you will produce in your experience. A really common New Thought expression is, energy goes where attention flows. You ever heard that? Energy goes where attention flows. And when we think rightly, we focus on spiritual truths. This means if we want to bring harmony into our lives, then we hold in consciousness thoughts of harmony and peace. If we want to manifest a physical healing, we need to mentally focus our attention on our wholeness, not on our pain or not on our diagnosis. If we want greater prosperity, we need to center our thoughts on God as the one unfailing source, not on our checkbook balance or not on our bills that pile up in the mail. Fox says, think God thoughts and give your attention to God rather than to the limitation. There's a story about an ancient village that year after year became victims of terrible torrential floods, and they lost property, they lost loved ones. It just happened again and again and again. And finally, a very wise man came through the village, and he said to the people, he said, I have a suggestion. Why don't you move from the valley and build your houses up on a higher plane, up along the mountain? It was a little difficult. It's harder to build on a mountain than it is to build in the valley. That's why they built there in the first place. But that's what they did. That's what they did. They built their village on a higher plane. And guess what? Did the flooding stop? No, it didn't stop. It still happened every single year. But they gave up the power over them. They could look down upon it, and they weren't directly affected by it. And maybe that's why Jesus took his disciples to the top of that Mount of the Beatitudes to give his lesson there, so that they could realize that we always can look at life and look at our problems from a higher perspective, from a higher place. And this is absolutely what Jesus demonstrated again and again as he looked beyond appearances always. If there was a healing, he looked beyond the diagnosis or the issue. If there was a lack of food, like he did with the bread, the loaves and the fishes, he looked to a higher place and he turned all of those negatives into positives. And even in the midst of darkness, and we have to be honest here, we cannot absolutely 100% control everything that happens on the outer. That's metaphysical malpractice to think that. I mean, there are lots of other people, you know, doing their own thing, and sometimes we are hurt by them, sometimes we're hurt by natural events, all of that. But here's the thing, even in the midst of the darkest time in our lives, we have the power to turn to the light. We have the power to choose the effect that that situation has on us and determine how we are going to respond. Because if we're honest, are we all not sometimes flooded? Flooded with negative thinking, flooded with worry, flooded with all of these negative thoughts in our heads, and we have to rise above them and go to the mountain. And so in this beatitude, Jesus is saying, blessed, happy, fortunate, in bliss are you if you have that strong desire for right thinking. Happy are you who recognize your oneness with all that is, for your ever-growing spiritual hunger is being satisfied. You are unfolding the enfolding Christ. You are coming to live in the consciousness that God's goodness is everywhere present and divine order is being established in your mind, your body, and your affairs. So, like the first two that preceded these two, the Beatitudes call us to explore what states of mind lead us to our own spiritual unfoldment, to think about and surrender to a power and presence greater than ourselves. As Michael Beckwith says, there's a vibratory frequency with every turn of the earth. If you are at the same place as you were 360 days ago, you didn't stand still, you went backward. Think about it. And so we are all constantly unfolding so that we can reveal the majesty and power of God. And we just need to put ourselves in that state of mind where we can ask the question every single day, how can I grow today? How can I engage in right thinking? How can I keep my mind open? How can I serve as God's expression on this earth? Because it's only when we give up the struggle and move to that higher consciousness, when we hunger and thirst for righteousness, right thinking, true thinking, then what needs to be healed in our outer lives will be healed. and insights, revelations, and answers we need will be revealed. And so it is. And so let's just take a moment now to put ourselves in that right state of mind about considering the nature and the power of the divine. There is only one presence and one power in the universe and at work in my life, God, the good, omnipotent, and so it is. Together, there is only one presence and one power in the universe and at work in my life, God, the good, omnipotent, and so it is.